dealing as well with a Congress that felt that any institutional arrangement except corporations was simply not acceptable. And that should be said and repeated, because if we are going to review this, we have to review it fairly. Well, Mr. Borbridge, sorry, we...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are a series of comments I would like to make on matters that I may not have discussed or clarified earlier, and I appreciate the questions that have been asked because they certainly have served to remind me of several items I want to mention. One is subsistence. Subsistence hunting and fishing rights were considered and addressed as one of the priority items by the Native leadership that and the Native people that worked on the 1971
Hanks. Maybe we could start again. We have perhaps 40 minutes before we have to adjourn, so maybe we could take our seats again and...
Sit him where Byron is. Byron is going to sit down here.
I'll leave this for if and when he...
Okay. Well, it always happens. We adjourned, and some of the, I think one or two of our panelists fled out the door, but we'll carry on. Maybe I could just say a word about how perhaps we ought to proceed now. I'd like to ask John Borbridge to continue, and then call in one or two others of you, and then tomorrow morning, maybe you could leave it to David Case and Rosita and Chuck and me to think about some more questions. And Mr. Joe Upikson, who has just arrived, perhaps we might ask him to speak tomorrow as well. And some of the and Mr. Byron Mallott has also joined us, and we might ask him to participate if he's able to do so tomorrow. I should tell you that some of the young folks here, we've drawn a bit of a crowd from time to time, are very interested in what we've been talking about, and some of them have said to me that they would like to speak, and in fact, one of them, Paul Frost, has seated himself at the table and has already spoken. And I think that perhaps is fair enough. Perhaps tomorrow sometime, when we've kind of run out of gas, if you don't mind, I'll ask some of these people who've joined us if they would like to speak. I think I should remind all of you that We're really trying to begin this overview by asking some of those who were present at Washington, D.C., active in the land claims movement in the late 60s and early 70s, well, what were you trying to do? What were your objectives? What did Alaskan Natives want to get out of this? It's inevitable, of course, that discussion brings us forward to the present, but that at least we've tried to make our starting point. And I know some of you were not around then, but please bear that in mind when we get to you tomorrow. So this is, I think, Mr. Borbridge, we've been introducing you, and you've been about to begin now for the last hour and a half.
Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased to be introduced again and to re-begin again. I just mentioned subsistence and the plug was pulled. But with respect to the issue of subsistence, I was stating that the Alaska Federation of Natives had clearly made subsistence one of its very priority positions. The high place that the issue of subsistence was held by AFN was clearly reflected in the Senate bill in 1970 and also in 71, where the subsistence provisions, which were intended to protect the subsistence hunting and fishing rights of the Alaska Natives, were pretty clearly spelled out. However, as happens when bills go into conference, the simpler House version prevailed on that point over the Senate bill, which had spelled out subsistence to a greater degree, which is why ANCSA has the somewhat limited subsistence provisions, which were later spelled out a little further in the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. I suppose it's another way of saying that the efforts that AFN made in those days and the place of subsistence should be judged more by what the Senate bill contained than what the final act contained. I also will comment on the issue of sovereignty. I had stated matters relating to the tribal status of the Alaska Natives and the sovereignty incident to that status were matters that fell outside the ambit of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And as it has been stated by a number of people who have testified at these hearings, ANCSA was a response by Congress to a promise made by that body in the Act of 84 and later repeated in the Statehood Act to define the extent of the rights of the natives to their lands in later congressional action. So ANCSA was a response to the loss of native claimed lands contrary to congressional promises to the state of Alaska. Although the 1971 legislation contained many complex provisions, it was and is a Land Settlement Act. It is more noteworthy for what it did not do to sovereignty and tribal status than it for what it did do. It did not purport, attempt to, or actually terminate the Alaska Native tribes. The tribal status quo existing before ANCSA, with the exception of land transfers to ANCSA Native corporations, which raises land tenure problems for the Native tribes, remains the same. In other words, we had an undefined status quo as to the tribal status of the Alaska Natives existing before ANCSA. It is something that the Interior Department had never completely addressed. And what I'm saying is that after ANCSA, it remained pretty much in the same category. Whatever our status as tribes, the fact that it was not spelled out in ANCSA or not spelled out before ANCSA was not adversely impacted by the passage of ANCSA itself. Another thing that's sometimes overlooked, I do assert for the record that the Alaska Native tribes asserted Aboriginal or Indian title to their lands. Now, true enough, this precise claim, which has a clear legal status, did not take us into the courts of the land, but it took us to the Congress. But again, we had to assert this as tribes. Now, true enough, it wasn't precisely adjudicated. But when the matter of our claims was considered before the Congress, I'm sure many of you recall that when we presented our claims and we asserted our rights before Chairman Aspinall, the first questions he asked was this: are you Native people entitled to a land settlement? What are your rights? Later on, the question came of how much and how should it be administered. But we had to get past the barrier. Were we entitled to a settlement? And history shows very clearly that the land rights that had been asserted by Indian tribes had been an assertion of Aboriginal title. We differed in one very important and unique respect from the status of the Indian tribes who had asserted Indian or Aboriginal title to their lands over the many, many years of the history of our country. In Alaska, there had been no extinguishment of this Indian title or Aboriginal title. We Alaska Natives were on and using the land. That's why I can't give enough credit for the people in the rural areas and the villages. Maybe sometimes they think that they were not able to articulate some of the technical aspects of the law or of the legislation, and maybe they wished they could have done more. I don't see, I say to the Native people in the villages, how they could have done more. Without them, we would have had a difficult time demonstrating and being able to assert we occupy our lands today. They played an important part, and sometimes we tend to pass over it simply because we're so used to it. But the people out in the villages, the ones that were asserting their rights and living according to the ageless subsistence use of their ancestors, were actually fulfilling all of the requirements that go into an assertion of Aboriginal title. We had to be functioning as tribes and asserting it as tribes. So it was really our clear establishment of the legal basis for our claims translated into land rights that persuaded Congress to enact ANCSA. And, of course, in the background, there was the need to transport the oil as well. I'd like to state for the record, we talk about a Claims Settlement Act, and we discuss how it benefited the natives. Let me discuss for a moment how that Claims Settlement Act benefited the nation. The nation needed the oil. A pipeline could not be built without the passage of ANCSA, which would be the vehicle for clearing title to the land over which the oil companies wanted to construct the Alaska pipeline. Because of the Claims Settlement Act, oil did flow to the rest of the nation. There also was a concern that was gradually gathering strength and momentum in our nation about the need to reclassify certain lands in Alaska and perhaps to preserve them for certain uses. The result of all of this was the building on Section 17D2 of the Claims Settlement Act, which later on was increased in scope and size to the D2 legislation, which became ANILCA, and which later on clearly impacted the entire country. Every state in the Union benefited because we had a Claims Settlement Act. I guess what I'm saying is when we discuss the beneficiaries of the Claims Settlement Act, let's not overlook some of the clearest beneficiaries. The third one being the state of Alaska, which was unable to proceed with the selection of its lands. Thanks to the natives, thanks to their statesmanlike posture of not wanting to hold things up and to impede the opportunities for the state to move forward, for the oil to be extracted and transported, and for whatever Section 17D2 might require in terms of a regard for the use of the lands for the future and for people who would come after, all of these benefited because of ANCSA. It is my privilege to be president of the Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indians of Alaska, which was a tribal governing body. I want to mention that before the Central Council had legal status as a tribal governing body, it was headed for 25 years by an unpaid president, Andrew Hope. And my opportunity was to come along at a time of history when the Claims Settlement Act that the Central Council and the ANB and had been pushing finally reached realization. The point I want to make is that in Southeast Alaska, through the Central Council, we had an entity which we, through which we asserted our claims of sovereignty. We stated, for example, that having our settlement funds administered for us by the Secretary of the Interior and deposited in the Treasury of the United States was clearly a privilege that only tribes could be expected to realize. And just as by the same token, the requirement for approval of attorney contracts for the Central Council, while restrictive, in another sense was beneficial because, again, it was clear to us that we were a tribe. This would only be asserted against a tribe. We tried informally by discussions with several congressmen to have the Central Council designated as an ANCSA entity. We weren't successful, but the feeling we had is we have a tribal governing body functioning, it's in place. Why should we have to create another entity in ANCSA to administer the land and the proceeds in Southeast? But again, we weren't successful, and again, it's largely because of the sentiment reflected in 2B, which was opposed to the creation of lands, more lands that would be in trust status. Senator Jackson, as indicated by Mr. Paul, was very strongly opposed to the provision which would increase the number of groups recognized as tribes and able to assert sovereignty and the amount of land in trust status. So that, to repeat, sovereignty was not a specific issue, but it was impacted by ANCSA. It was present in some of the threads in ANCSA. And again, I want to assert that the council was asserting its rights as a tribal governing body. With respect to the fisheries, in the Tlingit and Haida case, in which the Tlingit and Haidas had to assert their Indian title and then prove that they had used and occupied and asserted dominion over those lands, when they received a favorable judgment on the issue of liability in 1958, thereafter they had to proceed on the basis of proving how much. Commissioner Saul Gamer of the Court of Claims was given the task of making his more detailed findings on the case and reporting back his recommendations to the full bench of the Court of Claims. Commissioner Gamer reported back to the full bench with a recommendation that the settlement be for $15+ million. The full bench took this under consideration and they reduced it to $7.5 million. And the $7.5 million that was cut out of the recommended recovery was for the recovery on the fisheries rights of the Tlingit and Haidas. I guess what I'm asserting here is that what we decided not to appeal the case. This was during the pendency of the Claims Settlement Act. In a special convention, the Tlingitahaitis decided that it was more important to accept the judgment fund and not to appeal, even though we felt strongly about our disagreement with provisions of the proposed settlement. We decided instead that our organizational experience and such money as we would have would better be used as soon as possible in support of the Claims Settlement Act. It brings me to another point. The Tlingitahaitis were excluded from provisions of the Claims Settlement Act in the first several bills that came out. It was my privilege to work with AFN and the Congress and the Interior Department to change that. But rather than to go into the details of what happened, I just want to acknowledge that because of the vote of the other Indians in Alaska, the Eskimos and the Aleuts, the Tlingitahaitis became full-fledged partners. And it's a wonderful opportunity for me to say to all of you that are here is that's the way it worked, and that's the kind of brotherhood and sisterhood that we exercise. And for the record, it's just wonderful to be able to say thank you to all of you. Now, in case you're wondering why I seem to give credit to the Indians, Eskimos, and Aleuts, I'm a Tlingit. I married an Eskimo born in Bethel. My son married. I have two grandsons, and in their blood, they carry Indian, Eskimo, and Aleut. Just very quickly on other matters, I feel very strongly that the limitation of our proposal for a perpetual 2% overriding royalty was arbitrary and unfair. In any other society, when you talk about separating the surface estate from the mineral estate and the owner sells the surface estate and retains the interest in the mineral estate, this is logic, this is the law, this is fair. And that fairness was denied to us on a very arbitrary basis. I appreciate that the way the status of children born after December 18, 1971 was handled emerged as a major defect, and I have to share with that. I feel strongly about that, and I hope that we can change that. I would like to. On the matter of IRAs, when IRAs were proposed for our consideration, we had had experience with IRAs in Southeast Alaska. Two IRAs had managed the canneries in Angoon, and there had also been working relationship involving Heidelberg and Tluwak. The experiences were very discouraging and really did not work out too well for those two communities. There was a tendency by Interior during that time to interfere more from its position. That, I think, marks quite a change that I see between how things are now and how they were then. I think if Interior had been reacting more as it does today, which may be because we are so much stronger than they had back then in 71 and prior to 71, I really think IRAs may have been considered more seriously. As a matter of fact, in Southeast, several IRA organizations were dormant. They had ceased to function. They just, and yet with saying this, I truly wish that we could have, under improved conditions for our IRAs, considered them. I think if IRAs had the potential and we had the environment in Interior today back then, I think we may well have gone along with the IRAs. Regardless, the decision To go or not to go is made by the AFN board, clearly and at all times. The native people made all of the policy decisions. We had recommendations given to us, but that was the extent of it. I think I want to conclude, Mr. Chairman, by saying that I think the exercise of sovereignty is just an outgrowth of the appreciation of our tribal status as Alaska Natives. And I consider it really to be the issue of the 80s and maybe thereafter. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Borbridge. Just going in turn before we the time comes to adjourn, I think, Mr. Paul, perhaps we could call on you now.
We've had a lot of conversation about IRAs, and I thought I would make a record as to what my concept of the IRA is. There are two organizing sections to the IRA, Section 16 and Section 17. Section 16 is the tribal form of the IRA, and Section 17 is the corporate form of an IRA. Theoretically, Section 16 would perform civic functions, and Section 17 you would go into business with it, having a common membership, and most assuredly, you had to be a native to belong to it. There are certain restrictions on IRAs as of now. It can't sell its land, for example, and it has to get approval of the Secretary of the Interior to hire a lawyer. Those are the two principal restrictions. Now, under Section 16, I think most everybody in this room and throughout Alaska understand that the tribe performs certain social services by contract with the BIA. They engage in housing assistance and child welfare, Indian child welfare assistance, and a bunch of social programs like that. Now, it need not, however, confine itself to social programs. It can operate a business under Section 16 or 17. The reason why Section 16 is so inviting for business activities, as well as social services, is that there is a ruling out by the Internal Revenue Service that Section 16 need not pay any income taxes. Exemption from federal income taxes is, in my judgment, of magnificent value in operating a successful business. There are certain advantages. While I have been very critical of the Congress in conveying any land to Native groups the last 100 years, Congress has passed several methods of assisting Indian tribes in promoting their own welfare. I think everybody is aware of the Self-Determination Act, Indian Self-Determination Act, under which many of the communities administer their social programs. Tononaut Chiefs has it, Central Council has it, Ketchikan Indian Corporation does its own social service work under self-determination. But in addition to self-determination, in the business world, you have the Indian Financing Act, you have the Indian Loan Guarantee Act, where you borrow money and the federal government will guarantee repayment of the loan. You have the Interest Subsidy Act. In other words, in order to go into the market and get money from a bank, you're going to have to pay exorbitant interest, but the federal government will help pay the interest so that the interest won't be killing the business activity. And as I've indicated, Section 16 IRA entity has federal income tax exemption. It does pay, however, under a ruling by the state attorney general, it does pay state taxes. I was a little bit distressed because, as far as I know, the state's authority to collect business licenses and other state taxes from the Section 16 IRAs has never been contested. They're just paying it. Pardon me?
That's here in Alaska.
Yes, here in Alaska.
What about the lower 48? Do they pay state business license fees and state income taxes? Do you know?
Not on, they do, they're not on reservations. However, there is a case where a tribe for off-reservation business activities, the tribe must pay personal property taxes. Not real estate taxes, but personal property taxes.
What about state income tax for off the reservation?
I'm sure they don't, but we don't have a state income tax in the state of Washington, so I haven't really focused on it. Now, we've heard a lot about 1991, and I'd like to throw out an idea that is available to us today. It perhaps may require to have a full-blown optimum situation, may require some federal legislation, but it's workable under existing law. Let us assume that a village corporation, the Anxa Corporation, were to loan under more or less fair conditions, fair terms, money to its sister IRA with the purpose of having the sister IRA go into business. Let's assume it wants to build a warehouse at a place where a warehouse is needed, and you rent space to various tenants like fish processors, or a small hydroelectric plant, or a small cold storage. The loan to the sister IRA will be promoting essentially the same group of people who are stockholders in the Extra Village Corporation. And the sister IRA will pay no federal income taxes. So that the, and further, only natives can profit from the business activities of the sister IRA. You have to be an Indian or a native to belong to an IRA. That vehicle is usable today without any federal legislation. Now, regrettably, with maybe two exceptions, and notably Don Wright's Venati Reservation, the cooperation between the Anxa Village Corporations and the regional corporations, for that matter, on the one hand, and their sister IRAs essentially is non-existent. We must recognize that every village has its share of politics. And if the village leaders, both in the village corporations and in the sister IRAs, would bury their political differences, they could together cooperate and have a very viable business entity. I was born and reared on IRA. I was 21 when my father was able to convince Congress to extend the IRAs to Alaska. I was just entering law school. When I came back in 1940, I wanted to go into business utilizing the IRA as the business vehicle. Unfortunately, the Pauls are rebels, and the BIA would not give us assistance and, in fact, would do its utmost to discourage anything that a Paul advocated. So that my dream, if you please, of even having a pulp mill could never be realized. I utilize pulp mills as an example because it's an indication of the unlimited horizon that an IRA can have an ambition for. Regrettably, it never happened. Today is a new world, however. Like John was saying, today we push the Indian Bureau around. In those days, they pushed us around. When the canneries were being operated by the IRAs in Southeast, the real financial authority was some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C., who couldn't tell a salmon from a halibut. And yet he's the one who did the approval of the budget and who was going to make the loans and who would order the size of boats that these IRAs would finance. The anger that the maladministration by the BIA towards the Southeast IRAs was really deep-rooted. Now, I really can see a great horizon opening up if there would be cooperation between the Angster corporations and the sister IRAs. And this extends to the regions, too. There is no legal impediment for the regional corporation in my own area of Indian rights, Southeast, for the regional corporation there to loan money to its sister Klinkenhada tribes and let the Klinkenhada tribes save the income taxes that Sea Alaska, when it makes the money, would have to pay. Now, IRA has extended to Alaska, has another section that we don't talk much about. That's Section 2 of the 1936 Act. The Secretary of the Interior is authorized to create reservations up here out of the public domain. He can do it by signing his name to a one-page document. In the late 30s and, as long as Secretary Harold Ickes was Secretary of the Interior, there was a real movement to create possibly 100 reservations up here. I mean, may say for the record that I have finished a manuscript and delivered a copy to the commission and hereby authorize the commission to utilize it in any way it wants to. But in my manuscript, I have a list of the applications for reservations. I have a list of the IRAs, about 75 of them. And there was a great hue and cry led by our then Governor Ernest Greening and the multinational corporations in opposing the creation of these reservations. Vinatai actually was created then, 1.8 million acres, in the late 30s and early 40s. The list of the creation of the reservations is in the Federal Field Committee report, and I excerpted parts of it from my manuscript, so it's the detail is there. There were about 6 reservations. Taonik is another IRA reservation. But as Ickes' plan was developing, The opposition to taking land out of the public domain and conveying them to the IRAs throughout the territory then was mounting. We had headlines, and we had congressional hearings, and we had administrative hearings, and the language that appeared in the public press was pretty violent in opposing the creation of these reservations. Now, one reason why I want to mention Section 2 of the IRA is that we can dream here about having land in a trust position, all we want to, tax-free, only Indians can belong to the owner of the reservation. We have some protection from corporate raids, some protection from 1991, all we want to. But I also should say that there was this great movement in the 1940s. Unfortunately, Harold Ickes got into some sort of a quarrel with President Truman and resigned. Judas Krug became Secretary of the Interior, and Oscar Chapman and so forth, and they scrapped it, and it's never been revised since. Although even as late as the early 50s, there was introduced in the Congress bills to abolish that authority that the Secretary of the Interior had in the creation of these reservations. So we can dream about having this trust property where we have sovereignty, the full-blown sovereignty, not merely landless sovereignty, all we want to. But I'm also must say that it's been tried, and it would take a tremendous war chest, a lot of anxieties, a lot of nervous energy before it would ever be accomplished. And in view of Section 2, the one that John Hope read to us, it was the concept of the Settlement Act that all of these racial enclaves, these special property interests that Indians have through in the lower 48 by reason of treaties, is not going to happen up here. I favor it, but I also must say we have to be realists. I hope it's put in the report, but it's going to take a lot of doing to get it enacted in the Congress. Thank you very much.
Maybe you would, maybe when we come back tomorrow, Mr. Paul, we're kind of jumping the gun a bit here, but since you have given, in a sense, the case for IRAs and even suggested how the corporations might make use of the tax immunity of IRAs, perhaps you might reflect on the matter overnight and tomorrow sometime, give us the downside, the negative side of IRAs, so far as you can. We have a few more minutes. I wondered whether you, Martha Dementiev, or Lily McGarvey wanted to add anything before we adjourn.
I don't have anything to say on the sovereignty, water, territorial rights, fishing rights. I was unprepared for that. And I don't think there's going to be time left to speak on the thing that I'm interested in, is David Case's question, does owning the land risk the culture? So I might talk about that tomorrow, if I may.
Yes. Well, by all means, there's a microphone right over here that,
In your
It's right over here.
When you were speaking earlier, you said that you were talking to young people who maybe were too young to be around during the land claims. But I'm 37. I was 21 in 19... whatever. My name is Evelyn Hash Pete. I'm from Glen Allen, Otna region. I was one of the incorporators for the Cook Inlet Native Association. I would not sign up for the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act when my mother described it to me, Mabel Hash, because all that I had read about it up to that point told me that it wasn't, it was against my grain in the first place. And I'll go back to a party and I'll tell you what happened. We were having a fundraising party for ANSCA at my mother's house. And there were a lot of people there, maybe about 40 people. Some of them were Emil Nadi, some of them were Don Wright, and others. And Willie Hensley was there too. And they were talking about their efforts to go down to the United States Congress to lobby for the Land Claims Settlement Act. And I came in. I didn't know there was a party going on. And I came in and to my mother's house and heard them talking and couldn't hold it back anymore. And what I told Willie was that, why should we go to the United States government and ask for our own land back? And what we should, I was a little militant at the time, and I said what we should do is just seal off the border, not let any other non-natives come up to Alaska, and if necessary, and I said this, bomb Fort Richardson and Greeley. And I said, our ancestors were willing to fight and die for our land, and I am too. When we were describing our boundaries, we had no